Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Ken Rudin in Austin, Texas.
The other capital of the nation. Ken, what are you doing in Austin?
5 to 10.
Excellent. Now, let's move on.
No, actually, I am here courtesy of member station KUT.
Ah, and hats off to KUT, one of the excellent, most excellent member stations in the entire NPR constellation.
At least in Austin, right.
And, of course, another one of those stations that may be feeling the pinch if there's no more Corporation for Public Broadcasting next year, right, Ken?
Well, you know, Governor Rick Perry gave his State of the State address this week, and it was pretty bleak. It's interesting, when he ran for re-election last year, everything seemed to be peaches and herb. Peaches and cream, actually. But this year, the budget seemed to, a lot of cuts seem to be coming down the line, and a lot of people will suffer, as will people in many states. The state budgets are the big untold story politically this year, and it's pretty ugly.
Well,
if something can be pretty ugly.
If something can, and something right. will be, and in addition to what the states are suffering, the federal government is $1.48 trillion in debt for the current budget year, for which we don't actually have a functioning budget yet. And in the House, you have the Republicans putting forth tens of billions of dollars worth of cuts. That would include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which does, of course, fund many of the NPR member stations. So there's some very serious budget panic going on, not just in the state capitals, but also here in Washington.
There is, and that's why, actually, NPR has started the Impact of Government Project, which I am now a part of, which is to talk to member stations around the country and try to get reporters to focus on not so much what state government, state and local governments are doing, but how their decisions affect people.
And I think we should also explain to the listener that the reason you're in Texas this week is that you're on an exchange program, and that we sent from Washington to Austin you, Ken Rudin, and they sent us back that governor you mentioned a moment ago, Rick Perry, who, after he gave that speech, came here to Washington to give another speech.
And obviously, you're alluding to the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, that's going on in Washington Thursday through Saturday. And that is the big talk in Republican circles, because it seems like there's an impatience out there. I don't know if it's political journalists or Republicans themselves.
Both,
who are surprised. Yeah, I agree. Who were surprised that the 2012 battle for the Republican presidential nomination hasn't officially kicked off yet.
It hasn't, and maybe in the past we would have expected to see more people spending more time in Iowa or New Hampshire or modern times South Carolina, but right now most people are relating to this CPAC conference, which always gets a fair amount of press attention, as, if you will, the closest thing to a presidential contest that we've had so far.
Yes and no. I mean, we of course they have the straw polls, and in the past, I think in 2007, 2008, 2009, Mitt Romney won those straw polls. In 2010, Ron Paul won a straw poll, and obviously, as we well know, Mitt Romney and Ron Paul were elected president those years, so that's good. But more importantly, I think a lot of people are looking, one, to see what kind of reception these would-be possible potential candidates get from a conservative crowd, supposed candidates such as Tim Pawlenty and Mitch Daniels and Newt Gingrich and maybe Haley Barbour, things like that. Of course, one prospective candidate who won't be in Washington this week is Sarah Palin.
And she is, of course, getting a lot of the attention, despite the fact that she's not coming, partly for the fact that she isn't coming. But she does have a lot of other things on her calendar. And talk about minor kerfuffles that can be turned into something within the media. Rick Santorum, another would-be candidate, former senator from Pennsylvania, made reference to her skipping CPAC for business opportunities and made a reference to her being busy with her family, which then led to Sarah Palin saying, I won't call him a knuckle-dragging Neanderthal. Maybe I'll let his wife do that. So, you know, Sarah Palin seems to be able to dominate the chat even if she's not around.
Hey, well, two things. First of all, Rick Santorum said, you know, I understand maybe she needs to be with her children. And a lot of people say, wait a second, now why do female candidates have to have that responsibility? And why doesn't anybody say a male candidate, a man, has to stay with children? So she was upset with that, and rightfully so. But at the same time, it's not that she's fallen off the face of the earth. Last week, she was the main speaker at the Reagan Center, not the Reagan Library, but the Reagan Center honoring the Kipper's centennial. She had a very high-profile speech there that lasted about 30 minutes. But what was interesting, she got there, spoke, and left. There was no mingling. There was no talking. But if she runs, this will be a roadmap, basically, that no candidate has ever done before. I mean, she speaks on Twitter. She speaks on Facebook. She'll occasionally speak on Fox, but she won't give a major speech on foreign policy. She won't sit down for press interviews. So far, it's working for her because everybody, including us, just breathless about what she plans to do and what she is doing. But for the most part, there are like, you know, eight or nine other Republicans who are more specific about what they want to do.
So this is such a vacuum that we're dealing with. And it's so frustrating to Republicans who want to see somebody out there running and becoming a counterweight to Barack Obama. They're actually talking about a guy whose last name, I'm going to mention a four-letter word here, so the listener may want to cover the ears, Bush.
Well, we're talking about Jeb Bush, who, had he been elected governor of Florida in 1994...
Would have been a two-term president today.
He would have been the nominee and not George W. Bush, who was elected governor of Texas. The problem with this, first of all, the front cover of National Review this week had basically the arguments for a Jeb Bush candidacy. Most of it is that many conservatives are not exactly thrilled and excited about the prospective field that's out there, and they think that Jeb Bush would be a very good candidate. I think he would be a very good candidate, too, but he has said over and over again that he has absolutely no plans to run. And I still think, as you say, the Bush name is a four-letter word, not only just among Democrats, but there's some Republicans, especially Tea Party people, who feel that George W. Bush let down the conservative cause, the Republican cause, with the huge deficits, the wars that may or may not have been properly run. We could talk to Donald Rumsfeld about that. But I think Jeb Bush is really looking at 2016, if indeed he's looking at the presidency. But I think 2012 is out of the question.
He has said so repeatedly, including this week after his hand was forced by the National Review magazine cover story. But this is a serious discussion because the Republicans have returned to somebody named Bush several times now since Ronald Reagan. And we've just had the centenary of Ronald Reagan, and we've just had another spate of Ronald Reagan worship, which I think in the end is a real burden for the Republican Party because they keep looking for another Ronald Reagan. They keep looking for another, in their imagination, perfect candidate. It's a little bit like the way the Democrats hobbled themselves for years by looking first for another FDR and then for another JFK.
You're absolutely right. The Republican Party, if they're going to win, if they're going to beat President Obama, and if they're going to be a viable alternative to Obama, needs to look beyond just, you know, back to Ronald Reagan and hero worshiping.
Another thing I think that's affecting a lot of Republicans as they look on the shelf for the various products available to them for the presidential 2012 is they're a little more worried about Barack Obama today than they were 6 months ago. 6 months ago,
How about November 2nd? Don't even have to go back 6 months.
The day after that election, the shellacking, as President Obama called it himself, since then he has had an extraordinarily successful, well-negotiated lame duck session of Congress in December and gotten a lot done that some Republicans liked. He's also had a bit of a charm offensive, going to the Chamber of Commerce, talking nice to American business, getting a new chief of staff who is very much a business-friendly Democrat in Bill Daley.
Don't forget the speech in Tucson.
Yes, the Gabby Gifford speech, too, I think really improved the basic feeling of identity and connection that Americans want to feel from the president. Obama seems to have turned a corner with some of these efforts that he's made. This budget that he's going to pursue, he is probably going to wind up looking a little bit more moderate. That's a good place for a president to be as he looks to re-election. And his polls have come back up over the 50% mark in many cases, and presidents over 50% in approval get re-elected.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he's trying to sell himself as a moderate, as he is. Look, he's the president of the United States. And so while some progressives, some folks on the left, were not pleased about all the nice things he said at the Chamber of Commerce this week, this is exactly what President Obama should do, and he does it effectively by reaching out to his erstwhile foes, like, you know, when he met with the Republican House leaders this week, when he met with the Chamber of Commerce. He can almost point to the opposite. If the Republicans don't show any kind of reciprocal moves, if they show themselves very conservative or stuck in their ways, then he can sell himself in 2012 as, you know, the president of all the people and not of just one ideology.
So I think that's why a lot of the Republicans are now getting more concerned about their presidential field. They think they're going to need a good candidate and a good campaign, maybe a great candidate and a great campaign, if they're going to deny Obama a second term. It's not going to be as automatic as they assumed just a few months ago. You know, another thing that facilitates a president trying to turn around his political fortunes is to, in fact, lose some of the power in Washington to the other party and have the other party have a little difficulty dealing with it.
As we saw with Bill Clinton and the Republicans, congressional Republicans in 95 and 96.
Now, this we haven't gotten anywhere near the struggles of 95 and 96 yet. But what we have seen is that it's going to be a little difficult for the current House leadership, John Boehner, the Speaker, and some of his lieutenants, to manage this new majority of theirs in the House, because some of the Tea Party types and some of the people who are not associated with the Tea Party but are longtime conservatives who like to go their own way have now the independence in the majority they didn't think they had when they were in the minority.
Well, I think you may be alluding to the vote on extending the Patriot Act or some provisions of the Patriot Act this week that the House Republicans decided to take up under special order that basically you needed a two-thirds vote to pass. And one of the ways you grade a party in Congress is whether they know how to count votes. And obviously they thought they had the votes and they didn't. 26 Republicans, including libertarians who like Ron Paul, which is expected. But there were a bunch of freshmen as well, Tea Party backed freshmen who decided that let's wait a little bit before we just jump on and extend Patriot Act. Now, they could have waited. They could have passed it easily by a majority vote. They wanted to push it. I guess they wanted to just show that they're in charge. But by failing, I think it just sent a signal that they may not have a hand on their caucus the way they should.
Well, and of course, with the Patriot Act, they will come back. They will get a majority for extending these provisions, controversial as they are. But as you say, it's a managerial issue where they don't yet know whether or not they're going to be able to manage their caucus on a substantive matter is these budget cuts, where Paul Ryan, the budget chairman for the House Republicans, has come up with a list of pretty tough cuts for the current year, for the current budget year 2011. And a lot of the folks who are newer, not the leadership, but the new folks and the Tea Party-backed folks in the House Republican Conference are saying, not enough. We need double that, three times that. You've really got to get tough with this federal budget. And that's going to suggest a larger kind of rebellion and larger obstreperousness that might cause John Boehner some real problems.
Absolutely. You just analyze the difference between campaigning and governing. It's easy to campaign on just drastic, even draconian cuts, but to implement them when you're in power is another thing completely.
That's right, and it can be very frustrating. You know, one of the people I think found that very frustrating and decided this week that one term in the United States Senate was enough for him was Jim Webb.
You're talking about the Virginia Democrat who in 2006 beat George Makaka Allen in a squeaker by just 9,000 votes. And he, matter of fact, that was the election that gave the Democrats the 51st seat, the majority. You know, now we talk about how everybody's trying to get 60 seats. Back then, it was just a miracle that the Democrats got 51 seats. It gave them the majority in the Senate.
It was something of a miracle.
But Jim Webb was never, you know, first of all, he was kind of like an odd duck. He was never the kind of guy who felt comfortable in the Senate. He wasn't one of those, you know, backslapping, glad-handling kind of guys who for better or for worse, makes up for much of the Senate. He's a serious guy. He had serious issues. He opposed the war. He took on President Bush on the war. He's taken on President Obama on some issues as well. But he was never looked like he was having fun. Not that the Senate should be fun, but he never looked like he was enjoying it. And also the fact is he wasn't raising a lot of money. So when he announced this week that he wouldn't run again, while it was a surprise, basically you kind of knew, you kind of felt it was coming. But again, the fact is when you announce that you're not running again, everybody sits up and takes notice.
And he announced it on his 65th birthday, sort of an interesting grace note. I wonder if George Allen, when he declared some weeks ago that he was going to try to get his old seat back, wasn't suspecting that Jim Webb was not fully committed to running for a second term and that he would be essentially running against an open field of Democrats. Who do you see coming out of that open field of Democrats to contest Virginia?
Yeah, but before you say that, remember back then, Tim Kaine, who's the Democratic National Chairman, Tim Kaine said from the beginning that he was convinced that Jim Webb was going to run again, and he was asked, if Webb doesn't run, would you run for the seat? And Tim Kaine said, absolutely not. My job is to reelect President Obama in 2012. But now with Jim Webb out of the race, it looks like the Democrats are looking at Tim Kaine. They're also looking at Tom Perriello, who also lost his House seat in 2010. And, you know, George Allen, of course, doesn't have an easy walk to the nomination either.
No, actually, he will have a challenge from the right, it appears.
Jamie Radke is a Tea Party person who nobody ever heard of. And, you know, know, you wonder. I just remember that, you know, everybody's saying, well, George Allen is an establishment candidate. He's politics as usual. He doesn't inspire people like Jamie Ratke. They said that in Indiana, Dan Coats was a lobbyist. He was the old school. And forget about Dan Coats, you know. And so I mean, it's very possible that we could disparage George Allen all we want, and he does get returned to the Senate, but it won't be a cakewalk.
We've had some other goodbyes in Washington this week, and one of them that I think would mean something to the listener is Jane Harman, the congresswoman from Southern California representing a Los Angeles County district. Jane Harman had been in the Congress in the 90s. She left to run for what was it?
Governor in 98 and lost to Gray Davis in the primary.
But then she came back, reclaimed her seat in the next
round. 2 years later, right.
And then she rose to be, for a period of time, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, which was a job that mattered a great deal to her. But she tangled with Nancy Pelosi, who would eventually become the Speaker. And so when the Democrats took over the majority in 2006, Jane Harman did not get the chairmanship of that committee. And that was the beginning of a difficult period for her, which I think has become only more difficult, falling into the minority after the last election.
Jane Harman had a bunch of problems other than Nancy Pelosi. Of course, Jane Harman, by being an early advocate of the war in Iraq, by being somebody who defended, in many cases, Bush intelligence policies, she became anathema on the left. And Marcy Winograd, a progressive Democrat, liberal activist, ran against her both in 2006 and 2010 primaries. In 2010, Winograd got 41% of the vote. So a combination of her bad relationship with Nancy Pelosi, the distrust that many on the left felt for Jane Harman gave her the opportunity to leave. And when Lee Hamilton left the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, Jane Harman thought this was an opportunity and she took it.
So no more Jane Harman. Will her district back in the Los Angeles County area, will that remain in Democratic hands?
Absolutely. No question. It became much stronger Democratic after the 2002 redistricting. The only question is whether it becomes much more Hispanic after the redistricting later this year. But there's no question that the Democrats keep the seat. The two of the people who are running are likely to run are the Secretary of State, Deborah Bowen, and a Los Angeles City Council member, Janice Hahn. Her father was Kenny Hahn, who was a longtime Los Angeles supervisor. Her brother, Jimmy Hahn, was the mayor of Los Angeles.
Oh, well, all right. Sounds like another instance of the Hahn dynasty.
Don't forget Goldie.
That's good. That's good. While we're saying goodbye to Democrats, Jim Webb and Jane Harman, we're also saying goodbye to a group of Democrats.
Yes, that's the Democratic Leadership Council. Now, of course, Jim Webb and Jane Harman, in a way, come from this centrist mold, the moderate wing of the Democratic Party. And the DLC was formed, of course, after 1984, when Walter Mondale, of course, swept Minnesota and lost 49 other states. And they felt these moderate Democrats, led by Al Fromm and Bruce Reed and people like that, felt that the Democratic Party was moving too far to the left. And so this was the wing of the Democratic Party that produced the Chuck Robbs and the Sam Nunns and ultimately Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton, as a moderate centrist Democrat, gave the DLC a lot of heft in the 1990s. But then it started to fall apart after Bill Clinton left the White House.
That's right. And really, the DLC was more influential probably in raising Bill Clinton to the White House than it was in the Bill Clinton White House. Al Fromm was in the transition team, but not really a member of the White House team after that. And they were in and out of the government, and they were somewhat influential, but it was never really the apotheosis that they expected it to be at one time.
Right, but when you think of the DLC today, you think of people like Joe Lieberman, who is such an outcast in the Democratic Party right now. So I think the DLC, one, was not raising any money. Two, didn't have much influence, let alone influence in the White House. There was no reason for it to continue. Now, maybe if the Democratic Party shifts so far to the left again, if that should happen, although I think Barack Obama is too smart to let that happen. He's obviously consciously making a point of not having an ideological presidency. But unlike the Mondale-McGovern wings of the Democratic Party, maybe there's not a reason for the DLC to survive in this day and age.
One Republican has left Washington this week, rather unexpectedly, a second-term House member from the Buffalo area named Chris Lee.
Well, this was a big surprise. I mean, Chris Lee was elected to Congress in 2008, one of very few Republicans in the New York State House delegation, but he was thought to be an up-and-comer. He was elected easily in 2008, a landslide re-election victory in 2010, but then suddenly...
Okay, let's see if we can get a catalog here of things not to do. You're a 46-year-old married congressman.
You don't say you're 39.
You don't say you're 39, because that's just really unacceptable. It's wrong. And then the next thing you shouldn't do is say you're a lobbyist in Washington, because nobody really likes lobbyists in Washington.
And you should not take off your shirt.
Yeah, and then there's the taking off the shirt and going in the bathroom and standing in front of the bathroom mirror in your shorts, flexing your muscles, showing off your pectorals, and taking a picture of it with your iPhone.
We do that on the podcast every week, and I understand that. But you're not.
But you don't then send it off to Craigslist.
Not when you're a married congressman with a young son who hopes to have a future in politics and expects to run for re-election. You don't do those sort of things, and yet we keep seeing it. A lot of people were shocked that he resigned right away. Unlike John Ensign, who's still around and perhaps
still around,
David Vitter, although he won. You know, we keep seeing it happen over and over again, as Eric Massa was saying when he was tickling me the other day.
That's it for this week's Political Podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elber.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.